On May 18th and 19th, the Knoxville Symphony Orchestra will present our final concert of the season featuring Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, as well as works by Mason Bates, John Williams, and Richard Strauss. This performance will be led by Knoxville Symphony Orchestra music director Aram Demersian, who is here in the studio with me. Aram, thanks so much for coming in.
Hey, Garrett. Good to be here.
So you're about to complete your first season as music director of the KSO. How do you feel?
I feel great. You know, it's been a pretty wild ride. It's hard to believe that a little bit, maybe 3 weeks less than a year ago at this time, I was just getting the phone call telling me that the KSO wanted to hire me to be music director. And man, time flies. I've moved to Knoxville. I've gotten to know a whole new group of people. I've been very fortunate to travel the world this year. And now, finally, you know, at the end of this season, I'm getting to spend what I feel like is the first extended exposure to Knoxville that I've had ever since I've become music director. And it's home.
Yeah.
And I can see so many possibilities for the future of the KSO here in Knoxville. And, you know, my only regret is that we're about to hit the summer, because I just want to continue to build on the work that we've already done this season.
Yeah, that's amazing. We really have done a lot of great work this season. Let's rewind for just a minute. You mentioned, you know, under a year ago is when you got the phone call. What was that day like when you got the phone call and you hung up? What was your first thought?
My first thought was, I need to call my wife. No, actually, she wasn't my wife at that point. So I need to call my fiance. No, that was among my first thoughts. Mm-hmm. But one of my first thoughts was, man, life does not take you where you ever expected that you would go. Mm-hmm. I applied for this position really on a whim. I was a year and a half into my job as associate conductor of the Kansas City Symphony, and I knew that someday I would be applying to music director positions, and I happened to see the Knoxville job posted, and I thought, well, I've only been a professional conductor for a year and a half. There's no way I'm ready for this job. And then it was my father, an unofficial career counselor, who told me, just apply. It'll be good experience. So okay, great. Practice run, you know, for when I start applying for these positions for real. And I wound up getting into the semifinals of the process and then the finals of the process. And then after I came through here last January, I knew it went well, but I didn't know how well. Mm-hmm. And it just, you know, I guess the search committee determined that it was the right match. And so I was both shocked and overjoyed.
Yeah. Yeah, you mentioned how you weren't sure if you were prepared for the position, you know, and I've found from the musician side of an orchestra that you kind of grow into it. Do you feel like having this position has in itself made you a better conductor?
I think it has made me a better conductor. And, you know, I would venture that every experience that I have on the podium and every stop that I have, whether it's a full-time job, whether it's a music festival, certainly makes me a different conductor. Mm-hmm. Because you just add to your reserve of experiences that you can draw on. As I'm sure you know, every experience that you have in the past informs the next rehearsal that you have, the next collaboration that you make. And I find first years in places to be the most difficult, because you're the least certain of your surroundings. You are trying to react in real time to all of the new stimuli coming your way. And you're also trying to make the best impression on everybody that you meet and endear yourself to everybody that you meet all at the same time. Now, as music director, with this whole new level of responsibility and accountability that all conductors have, but that reaches a new order of magnitude when you're a music director. I mean, mm-hmm. the buck truly does stop with you on so many levels, administratively, organizationally, and particularly artistically. And like all artists, you just, over the course of time, carve out an identity of your own and your own way of doing things. And I feel like I've finally started to find my own groove as Aram Demersian, KSO music director, mm-hmm. maybe only in the last couple of weeks. And, you know, I don't know if I'm doing it the right way, but I know that there was a palpable shift inside of me a couple of weeks ago where I thought, okay, this is comfortable now. Now yeah. I know what we need to do together and how I can help lead that process.
Yeah, that's really phenomenal. And with any sort of relationship, but certainly a musical relationship, it seems like it takes a little time to fill things out and make sure it works. But from what you say, it sounds like you've begun to really, you know, cement yourself here in Knoxville and get a great idea of what your role is for the symphony and for the city at large.
Yeah, definitely. And on top of that also, I mean, you mentioned one of my favorite words, relationships. You know, art and particularly music is all about people and is all about communicating. And, you know, one can't really do that effectively until you really do get to know the people that you're around and begin to develop an understanding for them, a compassion for them, an insight into what their life experiences are, you know, what their desires for themselves, for their orchestra, for their community are. And I mean, I can't claim yet to have a full understanding of that on any level, but it's a heck of a lot better now than it was a year ago.
Well, that's great. Looking back at this season, what are some of the highlights for you? What are some of the more memorable moments you've had as music director?
Some of the more memorable moments I've had as music director. Well, okay, I was trying to think of what might be the most politically smart answer here. But when you said that, honestly, the first thing that came to mind was the November Masterworks weekend when we performed Copland's Appalachian Spring, which is a piece that means a lot to me.
Yeah.
I've probably conducted as much as I've conducted anything else in the repertoire. I have a very close emotional bond to the piece. It's just something that's always resonated with me. And the Friday night performance of that, I will say without a doubt, was the finest performance of that piece that I have ever been a part of. And everybody in the room, I think, could feel it, including the audience. I went back and listened to the recording a while ago and count. There was 20 seconds of silence after the piece ended. And that's when I had the first thought of, okay, I know this is going to work. There may be some, you know, there may be some growing pains, there may be some bumps in the road, but I know this is going to work. And then beyond that, that entire program was really the first little baby step, I would argue, in the direction that I want to see the orchestra go programmatically. It was for my second concert out as music director, I was a little bit nervous because it was a little bit of a risk because you had the Copland Appalachian Spring and then three pieces that were largely unfamiliar to our audience and any audience that, you know, Charles Ives' Variations on America, Jeff Midkiff's Mandolin Concerto, whoever thought of that, a mandolin concerto on a symphony stage, and William Grant Still's Symphony No. 1, the Afro-American Symphony, which, you know, used to be part of the canon and has kind of fallen out and was a piece that I discovered a little over a year ago and just, you know, felt like it was, you know, as an American conductor and William Grant Still being such an important American composer, it was important that we performed it. But there was very much a question in my mind of, you know, are people going to like this program? Are people going to respond to it? And when they did, that's when I had that first moment of, all right, you know, we can take the next baby step down this sort of unconventional road of programming, and I would venture that actually the May Masterworks concert is the next step that process.
Yeah, that's really a great segue. And speaking of pieces that are unfamiliar, we're beginning with a work by Mason Bates. So do you want to tell our listeners a little bit about this piece?
Yeah, oh man, okay. So Mason Bates is a phenomenal young American composer based out of Chicago, and he writes music in all sorts of different styles, mostly for orchestra, but his calling card is that he combines acoustic orchestral sound with electronica. So Mason he's also a DJ in addition to being a composer.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And the electronica sound that he uses is just, you know, run through a computer, you know, what you would find a sort of high level DJ controlling if they were at a nightclub or something. And he manipulates this electronic sound in fascinating ways so that there's as broad a color palette and a tone palette as you have in the acoustic orchestral sound. But he does it in a way that's really not a gimmick at all. The electronic sound and the acoustic sound almost harmonize is not the right word, but they function in harmony with each other.
Right.
They're connected, and you know it's not even so much that you know you have these two interesting sounds from two different worlds, but you have them coming together to form an entirely new sound that is characteristically the Mason Bates sound. And
yeah.
Mothership was a piece that he composed for the YouTube Symphony in 2011, which was conducted by Michael Tilson Thomas. MTT is a big advocate for Mason Bates' music. And the idea behind Mothership is he conceives of the orchestra as a mothership in which visiting alien instruments can dock and play solos from time to time. And with the YouTube Symphony, they found their soloists from all over the world by posting a recording of the piece and encouraging people to submit videos of themselves improvising over, and then they had them into the performance. And so I thought, well, you know, one thing that I knew about Knoxville early on was how there was such an incredibly rich music community here and such a diverse musical community here. I thought, wouldn't it be cool if we could do the same thing and really try to bridge some of the gaps in between our various corners of the musical world in Knoxville, which is exactly what I want to do over the long term here. Is I really want to make the KSO a gathering point for all music in Knoxville and a gateway into all the great classical concert music that we play, but to make it a context where people feel comfortable regardless of what their background is, so that they can feel just as comfortable going to the Tennessee Theater to hear the KSO as they are going to the Pilot Light or to Mill and Mine.
Right.
We have two great soloists that are going to be participating in Mothership. We have Christina Horn of the electronic music band Hudson K, and she's gonna play a guitar, and it's gonna be awesome. And then we have a UT faculty member, actually, named Jorge Variego, who has played in the KSO before on bass clarinet, and he's going to be playing his bass clarinet, but he's going to be, I don't completely understand it, but he's going to be running the sound through a computer, and it's going to be like delayed 16 times over or something like that, so it's not going to sound like your typical bass clarinet.
Right. Right. Yeah, that sounds really exciting. And so on the show I host, the afternoon concert, I do air many of the, you know, the standards, the pieces that people know. But I also feel like it's really important to expose everyone to the music that you may not know, just to prove the point that classical music is still alive and it's still an art form that is very much relevant to today. So what is your goal when you're programming these newer pieces of music that many people don't know?
I want to find the middle ground, or not even the middle ground, but the meeting point, the intersection. I guess that's middle ground. The intersection between the idea of tradition and the idea of innovation, because I think that they're actually indelibly linked. In our music world, I find that it's very easy to, you know, you're either a traditionalist doing Beethoven and Brahms, or you're an innovator conducting or playing in a contemporary music ensemble. When the reality is, most of us as performers do a little bit of each, and tradition is not necessarily something old. Tradition is the renewal of something now, in the present.
Right.
And tradition is constantly evolving, but tradition only exists based on what the present day bearers of that tradition do with it.
Yeah.
And so that's why I think, you know, programming new music and innovating and advancing the art form is part and parcel of the tradition of classical music.
Absolutely, yeah.
And I, you know, and that's why I think it is so vital that we continue to commission composers, that we continue to program new music, and that we continue to engage in this dialogue through our performances and through our programming, this dialogue between where we came from and where we are now, which, you know, I mean, you can say that dialogue, that awareness of the thread of history, you know, from the past into the present and, you know, charting a course to the future is increasingly vital to all aspects of our society now.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And speaking of a tradition, there will be more traditional pieces of music on this concert, including the Till Eulenspiegel and Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. Why do you think Beethoven's Fifth is one of the most well-known pieces of music to ever exist?
That's a hard question to answer. If I had to take my best guess, I would say because of the way he wrote it.
Mm-hmm.
Because of, I'm a firm believer in the connection between music and memory. And anytime a composer writes a piece, even when it's new, writes it in a way that the musical language, by the time you get to the end of the piece, feels familiar.
Mm-hmm.
I think those are the pieces that more immediately resonate with audiences, that take less time to sort of, adopt an oral palette for. And in Beethoven's Fifth, you have him, that motive. Da-da-da-dum! The repetitiveness of that motive and its presence throughout the entire symphony, all four movements. First of all, it's just a great musical idea. And then the fact that he really... He limited the amount of musical material that he used. He limited what the ear had to process, and yet he created such an inventive symphony that it just it just captured people's imaginations is the best that I can say. And there's no debating how ubiquitous and universal Beethoven's Fifth is. I mean, I was just on ESPN.com a couple of days ago, and I was watching a video on the 15th anniversary of Allen Iverson's, we're talking about practice, press conference, and it was looking at the history of that and how the legend of that has grown over 15 years, and the soundtrack was the first movement to Beethoven's Fifth Symphony.
Oh, wow.
So that's just my most recent encounter with Beethoven's Fifth.
Right. Yeah. And it's such a famous piece, and we really look forward to performing it and hearing it. It's going to be a great show. So as we reach the end of this season, obviously you're thinking about what's ahead of us. Can you give us a sneak peek as far as what you have planned for maybe the July 4th show or well into next season?
Well, the July 4th show, I'm going to hedge on that actually, because we are deep in the throes of planning it right now, and I can't make too many promises.
Sure.
It will be a fun show filled with music all by American composers, to be sure. There will be I can tell people that there is going to be a John Williams section to that program because he turned 85 this year, and it's also 40 summers after the premiere of Star Wars, so there's definitely going to be some Star Wars on there. And I am increasingly actually fascinated by the music of John Williams.
Oh, it's amazing.
It's amazing, and if you talk about who's the most important American composer, one could make a strong argument for John Williams, because he is, as orchestral musicians, he is our most valuable asset in terms of introducing people to the symphonic sound.
Yeah.
So that's partially why he's on this last Masterworks concert of the season, because he truly is, a masterful composer, and I wanted him to be featured next to all of this other great music. But next season, I'm very excited about next season. Next season is just yet another step down this road toward a new, I guess, again, you could call, unconventional philosophy surrounding programming. We'll be playing so many great classics, including Rachmaninoff symphonic dances, Barber's Knoxville Summer of 1915, Dvorak's Eighth Symphony, Rimsky-Korsakov's Scheherazade, on Rhapsody in Blue by Gershwin, onward from there. But we'll also be performing music by seven different pieces by living composers, two pieces by female composers, a number of pieces by non-white composers, and a number of pieces that the KSO has not performed in either ever or at least as far back as our programming archives go.
I mean,
Hina Stera's Four Dances from Estancia comes to mind on the October Masterworks, which we are going to be choreographing with Appalachian Ballet. collaborations running throughout the season, like with Appalachian Ballet, like I talked about, the Carson Newman Choir, the UT Brass are all going to be featured on our first program of the year, which is all about Knoxville. We'll be commissioning an overture that's inspired by the indigenous Appalachian roots music of the area. Mm-hmm. On the last Masterworks of the Year, we'll be playing a piano concerto by Florence Price, who is really the first African-American female composer to have her music performed by significant orchestras. And every program also, we strive to give every program a theme, a through line, so that anybody, regardless of their level of understanding or familiarity with the repertoire, has something that they can latch onto in the program and use that as their point of orientation. And then we, as performers, will help guide them through the rest of the program. And that applies to our chamber classic series as well. I mean, you know, of course, there's going to be, you know, like Mozart's 41st Symphony, the Jupiter Symphony, Haydn's Symphony No. 60, the Distracted, Il Distratto. But there's also going to be some great new works like H.K. Gruber's Frankenstein for baritone, chansonnier, and orchestra. And trust me, this is a very, very zany, weird, awesome piece of music. Osvaldo Golahov's Last Round. Golahov is a composer that I'm increasingly programming more and more. Bach's Brandenburg Concerto No. 3, right next to Christopher Theophanidis' Muse, which was a piece that was written, inspired directly by Bach's Brandenburg Concerto No. 3. So I think next season is certainly going to be a season of discovery and reinvention for us at the KSO, and I just hope that people are excited to hop on the ride with us.
Yeah, it sounds like our plate is full.
Yes, for sure. And I, you know what? The summer will be a good time to recharge the batteries and spend some good quality time with all this music.
Well, Aram, thanks so much for coming in to speak with me today, and we all look forward to this season finale concert.
Thanks, Garrett.
You can hear Aram Demersian and the Knoxville Symphony Orchestra in the season finale on May 18th and 19th at the Tennessee Theater in downtown Knoxville. More information on this performance and tickets can be found at knoxvillesymphony.com.